You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations.
Hey, that's a funny looking deck, man. How do you play poker with these?
They're tarot cards.
You are familiar with the tarot?
I wouldn't say that, but I've seen the cards before.
Dr. Schreck, doctor of metaphysics?
The science which investigates the first principles of nature and thought.
And nonsense.
Schreck is a German word, isn't it? It means fright, fear, something like that.
The more exact translation would be terror. An unfortunate misnomer, for I am the mildest of men. However, I sometimes foretell things that are frightening.
With these? They are the key.
Yes.
The key?
The key to what? Ancient wisdom. The tarot deck is a picture book of life. An answer to the deepest questions of philosophy and history. And sometimes, a means of prediction.
Like fortune-telling?
Of a kind.
What kind?
There is, within each of us, a twin destiny. The natural and the supernatural. The cards are attracted to the supernatural part of that destiny as one pole of a magnet attracts an opposite pole.
Supernatural part?
The strange, the weird, the unknown, the terrifying, the mysterious. At one time or another during our lives, we may, any one of us, encounter it. This deck can forewarn us. I call it my house of horrors.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
That excerpt in the introduction was a clip from the 1965 horror film Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. It's a fun horror movie from Amicus Films, a small studio that specialized in what Americans call anthology films and what the Brits usually refer to as a portmanteau movie. That was Peter Cushing as Dr. Terror, and the rest of the cast includes Christopher Lee and Donald Sutherland, among others, with the vignettes of the tale being anchored together with the framing story of Dr. Terror reading the fortunes of fellow passengers in a train compartment. But before we get into our episode, first, a little business. Today is the first episode in a new format for Monster Talk. I'll talk more about this in the body of our discussion, but the quick version is we're changing to a weekly format and are committed to this schedule at least to the end of 2022. Our research suggests that podcast audiences want frequent episodes released regularly and, perhaps because of changes in driving and commute behavior, that shorter episodes are preferred. But don't panic. Even though we'll have shorter episodes, that won't equate with shallower research. Our plan is to continue to bring you strange and unusual stories about monsters and monster-adjacent content, and to use that content to promote science and critical thinking. If you're a longtime listener, we hope you'll be patient and give this approach a try. And if you're new to the show, we hope you'll dive in and listen to our back catalog as well as enjoying our latest releases. Patreon backers will continue to get extended commercial-free versions of the show. This episode also kicks off Season 2! Going forward, we plan to start new seasons each October because we're big fans of Halloween and the spooky season, so starting our new format in our favorite month feels right. Now that we've dealt with that business, let's shuffle on to our tarot research, a topic we think will suit you.
Monster Talk.
Karen and I are going to change formats a little bit. We're going to try, well, we're going to do it. We're doing this. We're switching to a weekly format. It's an experiment, but we're going to stick with it for the rest of this year for sure and see how it goes.
Yeah.
That's, you can look forward to an episode every week from now until the end of 2022 and maybe beyond, but that's at least the current plan.
Hopefully beyond. Yeah. I mean, people want more Monster Talk, so we're giving it to them.
And I am excited. Because we're going to talk today about the history of tarot. Now, I am going to be talking about tarot, the divination everybody's familiar with, but I'm also going to talk about the game. And if you'll indulge me, I want to tell a little story about why I want to talk about this topic.
Go for it.
Okay, super. I was looking for your the explicit permission. All right. So my family, we like to go to bookstores. That's what we do. That's our thing. We like
us
books.
Too.
Yeah. And so I have always said
there are fewer of them than they used to be.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, but we love a secondhand bookstore. We love to give, you know, new homes to old books, that sort of thing. My daughter, Madeline, I'm gonna go ahead and name and shame. She is my most let's say occult curious family member. So she was the first one to ask to get a Ouija board, for example. And one day we were at the bookstore and they have at our used bookstore near us, they have a really large occult section with all kinds of things about witchcraft, Wicca, astrology, New Age stuff. And, you know, I'm always over there because I'm always looking for ghost books and monster books. But they also have a big bin full of tarot cards. And she found a tarot deck. And there's a lot of different artwork on these now. There's quite an industry built up around this. And she found a deck that she wanted to buy. And I was concerned because I didn't want her to just hop right into the divination, into the pool, without being aware that the history of it included like a card game. And just and so I said, look, I'll buy you this tarot deck, but what I want from you is a 500 word report on the history of how it switched from being a card game into a divination tool.
Oh, you're a hard taskmaster.
Well, I suck is what the actual thing is. It's like, because what I should have done is said, yes, I'll buy this for you upon receipt of a report. Okay. Well, yeah, I was like, a year goes by and she still hasn't given me the report. And I'm like, okay, listen, I don't believe you're going to fulfill your obligation. So I'm getting ready to do.
You're going
to
take them back?
And I'm not going to take them back, but I said, you have to understand where this comes from. So I'm going to do a Monster Talk on this. And although it's regular feed content, I mean, it really fits in nicely with our History of Magic series we've been doing intermittently.
But that'll teach her.
And right, exactly. Yeah. You have to listen to this because I want you to know where it comes from. So, and I learned a lot preparing for this. So I feel well informed.
I find it interesting that you talk about this originally being a game, because I think most people today think about tarot cards in terms of a system of divination, predicting the future, fortune telling. I don't think most people think or know that it was once a game.
Yeah, certainly not in America and in English speaking countries. It turns out if you are in French speaking countries, Tarot, the card game, is still extremely popular. So the card game...
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So there's a cool video. I put a link in the show notes. There's a cool video that explains how the game is played. And it's called a trick-taking game. So I'm trying to think, like some other games, like trick games are like Euchre or Hearts or Bridge, where each round, everybody has to play a card, and then each round, someone gets to take those cards for points. And there's all kinds of interesting rules about how the points work. But it is a multi-round game, and you try to take the most tricks and get the most points. It is, and it's played with, it's a little bit different from a regular card deck, or like American playing cards or traditional, you know, poker cards, for example. You know, a traditional poker deck has four suits. Like we would think of hearts, clubs, diamonds, and spades. But there are other suits. For example, Spain and Italy had cups, coins, and swords. Chinese cards had suits that were based on money. There's bells, tiles, acorns, shields, leaves. So just you basically need four easy-to-spot symbols. And if you think about it, card games are kind of a technology. They've evolved over time, right? So as better paper making and reproductions, you know, have come along, they've changed and improved.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that you compared tarot to bridge, because I keep reading about that and hearing about that as well. And I have never played bridge myself. I've often just associated it with, I guess, older people playing it on a cruise ship or something like that.
I always associate with like a upper classy kind of thing, like, you know, something that people, wealthy people with time do. I don't that's not really fair, but that's the way
it
sits in my head.
Play bridge, yep. But yeah, it's interesting that there is that relation there and similarity. And I don't think most players of bridge would see that or recognize that.
Maybe not. I mean, I imagine if you showed them the game, they would certainly quickly pick up on it, because it is really...
See the similarities.
Yeah, it's what's different about it is you've got your four suits of cards, and then you've got this extra, which are called trump cards, and there's 21 of those, and they can be used in play... depending on which rule set you're playing with. So that they might be able to, you would normally have to play within like a sequence, or you'd have to play a color, or you'd have to play a suit, but you might be able to pull from your trump deck, and then, you know, and then someone else might have to pull from their trump deck. And then there's like, you know, the numeric value can matter. There's the rules of the game are complicated, but understandable. This little YouTube video is about 9 minutes long, and it made perfect sense to me. I didn't feel like I could sit down and play immediately, but it was not too complicated. The point calculation was...
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've heard too. But you mentioned Chinese cards, and I think that's one of the things I kept coming across, were these references to tarot having its roots in either the I Ching, Chinese cards of some kind, or Egyptian playing cards too. And you mentioned European countries, so France and Italy. So I've heard these two schools of thought, that tarot cards go back to Europe, maybe the 14th century or 15th century, or that they go all the way back to ancient China or ancient Egypt or even ancient Greece or Rome. What do you make of all of those different theories and claims?
So there's a really easy way to sort of cut through that. And that is not a card pun. But in order,
yes, it is.
In order to play cards, you need to have mastered the technology of paper. And so we know that the ancient Egyptians did not have paper, nor did the ancient Greeks.
Very good point.
Papyrus actually doesn't make good playing cards, because it's almost like a weave. And it kind of falls apart if you try to make cards out of it.
Never thought about it, but yeah, now that you mention it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like as soon as you think of it, oh, yeah, I guess you would need paper. So the Chinese had mastered paper by the year 1000 AD or CE. And we have references to something that sounds like card playing back into the 10th century CE. But It's not until the 1100s and 1200s that we for sure know there's textual records of not only the names of the game, but the games were being played with cards. So the likeliest path is Chinese game developers developed card playing, and then it migrated to the Middle East, where it developed into something kind of like what we would think of as modern poker playing cards. And then that was the standard deck for a long time. Around the 1300s, the game of tarot was developed in Italy, and it had the, again, it had the four suits plus the trump decks. And these were like things you'd have commissioned. These were not mass produced. So the games existed in cheaper forms, but families with money would, you know, commission artists to make one of a kind card decks. So a lot of the ones we have in museums are where someone's produced a page of cards, but they never cut them. So they survived. Mm. Right. Whereas if you played with them, they would probably not. Mm-hmm. So
how interesting that is to think about them in a different format.
Uh-huh. In fact, if you go look, I've got lots and lots of links for this episode. There are some really good books on this. In fact, let's hold off on discussing what books I use for researching this. But the big problem with these books is that they were often only printed once, even though it's some great research. They're not easily found. So you might have to look online for a PDF. I'm always concerned about the legality of this, the Scribd.com website. I use it, and it's an incredible source for information. Copyright be damned. It's awesome. It's like you pay a fee. I don't know. I'm hoping the money gets back to the author.
Well, I was going to say, you pay a fee too. Yeah.
For doing research for this show, Scribd, Kindle, newspapers.com, all of which I could not afford if it weren't for our helpful patron support. Thank you. They really make this possible. But yeah, there's some great books on this, and they have pictures of these uncut card sheets and of the artwork and how it's changed over time.
Spring? Is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely there fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. That means more comfort and less baggage. Experience how Allbirds is redefining comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com, code SUPER24.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's if you will recall, during our series on magic, we've discussed the rise of Western esotericism.
That's episodes 150 and 151, which were on Western esotericism and Aleister Crowley,
which is alongside the
I hear a pun in that somewhere.
There's probably going to be some. You'll just have to deal with it.
Sounded like tarot, but
yeah. Western esotericism. Yeah, nice.
Yes.
You know what, Karen? Yeah. I'm going to give you the points for that one because I didn't think of it. That's you. Congratulations.
Well, even when you don't try.
So I sat down and was reading up on this, and I came across a particular book called A Wicked Pack of Cards, Origins of the Occult Tarot by Michael Dummett and Ronald Decker. Very smart guy, philosopher, historian, and one of the things he got really interested in was tarot and the game and the occult side of it. So he's written several books. He's passed away, but he wrote one in 1980 that's all about the origins of the game. It goes into deep detail about the various decks that have been produced all the way up to 1980. And, you know, how the game is played, you know, again, it still exists. You can still go to casinos and stuff and play tarot. in French-speaking countries, probably in other places too, but like it's still very popular.
Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea.
I had no idea either.
Really interesting, but I guess this is kind of where you're headed. But what I'm wondering is, at what point did this go from being a card game to having some kind of mystical meaning or purpose and usage?
There is a deck that's called the Tarot of Marseille, and it's an Italian tarot deck that becomes super popular in the 1600s and 1700s.
Oh, I would have thought that'd be French, Marseille.
That's the interesting. It's an Italian deck that gets imported into France where it blows up. It becomes a huge popular deck. And it's used in card gaming, but it's also used by cartomancers. And we should discuss here for a moment, the process of divination through the use of cards is called cartomancy.
I think that term's used, or mancy is the suffix is used for a lot of different kinds of divination, like bibliomancy.
Yes.
As well, fortune telling using the Bible or the Torah or the Quran. I mean, really, you can use any kind of book, or you could use anything for divination.
Yes, anything with a random factor. Yeah.
Well, if I can mention my book, Language, Myths, Mysteries, and Magic here. I've got a whole chapter on divination.
I'm sorry, we don't have time for a commercial. No, I'm just
That's what this is all about. But I write about the casting of lots and how you could really use anything. Historically, people would use sticks, stones, and bones, and coins, and shells, and things like that. And, of course, today we're familiar with people reading tea leaves and coffee grounds and crystal balls. And I think in the past we've certainly spoken about palmistry and reading hands. And I've written articles in the past about people reading things like toes and even bottoms. I think it was Sylvester Stallone's mother.
Yes, yes.
Claims to be psychic and says that she can read people's backsides.
She did. She's passed away. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, I do write about that in my book. And I mean, that's possibly for another topic too, because it's just so many different forms of fortune telling.
You would tell her about your hopes and dreams, and then she wrecked them.
Nice. Well, we will have to talk a little bit later about, so I don't know if you've ever had a tarot reading or done a tarot reading.
Absolutely. Well, we shall discuss that. Wikipedia has a page about forms of divination, and they list more than 400 different things that people use to try to predict the future.
With more than 400 specialized words for forms of divination, I'm just going to mention a few to give you some idea of the scope of how randomness can be used to give a sense of predictive power. Some of these techniques have elaborate rituals and systems, while others just seem to be like dice, or there's just randomness in the system, and therefore it can be used to make a choice. Math, planets, animal guts, the wind, arrows, smoke, cards, sticks, overheard words and conversations, the mutterings of madmen, dreams, calendars, blood, body fluids, eye color, the moon, tea leaves, candle wax, coins, fire, biblical texts, gazing into liquids or mirrors, and on and on.
Which I think, like that you were saying, sticks and stones will break your bones, but they can also tell the future. What?
Sticks and stones, yeah. But previous guest of ours, Lynn Kelly, she had come up with her own system of divination. I think it's called taromancy, and I think it was using a pick up sticks or something similar to that. But really, you could truly use anything. But I think in terms of just aesthetics and art, tarot cards are very beautiful. And
They are.
You know, you've already touched upon the different kinds of decks that you can find. And today you can certainly find a lot of really fun ones on Amazon or just online in general, or even at the bookstore. You know, I've seen ones like the Simpsons cards and a Golden Girls tarot deck, cat themed ones that you would really love. You're a big cat fan.
Oh, huge and, cat fan. Yeah.
But I also came across a classic rock tarot, which had Ozzy Osbourne as Death and Axl Rose as the Fool. I thought that was pretty clever.
Amusing to see him on a tarot, since he's got that song, Mr. Crowley. And Aleister Crowley, who he's actually singing about, but mispronouncing his name.
Nice lead-in.
Famously produced a deck as well. But let's, before we hop into the late Victorian period, let's go back to the 1700s, where after 400 years of traditional card play, suddenly cartomancy becomes all the rage, all right? So what happens is this Marseille deck is quite popular, and there is a guy named Jean-Baptiste Alliet, who is a Frenchman and a bit of a rogue and a writer, and he invents a form of card divination using what's called a stripped deck. It's like a 32-card deck of cards. They call it a piquette deck. It's a standard playing card deck with the 2 to 6 cards removed. So you just have the 7 through 10 and then the face cards. It is interesting that a lot of these tarot decks traditionally didn't have a queen card. They had other face cards, but they did not have a queen. If you're listening to this and you already know lots and lots about tarot, you may be disappointed in how little I'm going to get into the symbolism in this discussion. And that is not because I don't care about it. Far from it. I care a lot about it. But it is so broad. It's so important to it, to the whole process. Yet there's so many different decks with so many different meanings. And then
different interpretations.
And exactly. And so it's like, hours and hours and hours, and you would never be done. It's just, we're just going to step back from that level of inquiry and just work here through the broader stuff. So
it can be the subject for another show sometime. Yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, Jean-Baptiste Alliet also goes by the name Attila or Attila or maybe poorly.
Was his name
Attila
backwards or something?
Yeah, it is his name backwards. Exactly. It's his writing name. It's just a nom de plume. He writes a book called Etiela, or A Way to Entertain Yourself with a Deck of Cards. And it is a explanation of how to use cards to tell the future. And largely as a form of entertainment, you know, he's not trying to get in trouble for, you know, being a witch or anything like that. It's 1770, so it's really the Enlightenment. And which is interesting, because what I'm about to reveal is that the tarot, as we understand it, is about the same age as America, as a democracy, as a country. It's right the same period of time. That's how old it is. It does not go back to ancient Egypt.
Right.
So I'm just going to read a little excerpt from Wikipedia.
Unlike most things, I think it's a fair enough kind of assumption or guess, because so many things do go back to ancient societies.
Well, divination certainly goes way back. But what was happening in the late 1700s, France was going through this, what everybody calls Egyptomania. Like everybody was interested in Egypt. And then keep in mind, this is still before Napoleon takes troops to Egypt and actually conquers it, right? Just culturally, everybody's really interested in Egypt. So, again, I'm going to read from Wikipedia. In 1781, the French-Swiss Protestant clergyman and occultist Antoine Court, who named himself Courtigeblin, I believe is how that's pronounced. It could be Gebelin, but I don't think so. It's Courtigeblin. He published a massive work, Le Monde Primitif, The Primitive World, and his idea that the tarot was actually an ancient Egyptian book of arcane wisdom. His work included the essay by the Comte de Millet, who first called tarot cards the Book of Thoth, or Thoth, or Tote, and crucially claimed that the Egyptians used the cards for fortune-telling and described what purported to be their method of divination. Now, that's after the 1770 book, which was using regular playing cards, right? So different guy, same period of time, comes out and says, look, I've looked at this Marseille deck. I've looked at these cards. These are not just playing cards. These are actually artistic representations of ancient tablets from Egypt, and they have secret wisdom in them. It is the Book of Thoth, or Thoth, or Thoth. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But the ibis-headed god.
Take your pick.
Yeah. It's the secret of this. It is brought out of Egypt and hidden, as the word occult means hidden. It's hidden in these cards, and they're actually able to tell the future. So this book is super popular, and Aliette goes back and writes a sequel book called Tarot, or How to Entertain Yourself with the Deck of Cards Called Tarot in 1785. And that, in addition to the Marseille deck, is what sort of goes viral. That's what gives us the big interest in tarot as divination tool.
Right. Makes me think, too, that this is an appeal to antiquity. Oh,
it absolutely is. Yeah.
Practice, well, and we've been doing this for thousands of years. How could it possibly be wrong?
And it fits right into the same sort of secrets being told about the Masons and the Illuminati. These secret societies are a big part of the sort of history of Western esotericism. I mean, this idea that, you know, that there is knowledge about the universe and it's available to humans, but you just have to know how to decode it.
It comes
from mystical practices.
Law of attraction.
The law of attraction. Kabbalah is a big one. Huge. People who do tarot often incorporate astrology and Kabbalah type techniques and arrangements and symbolism into their decks or into the way that they read their decks.
I just have to comment and say that the story of tarot seems to have everything. It really seems to bring everything together and to touch upon everything you can think of with regards to metaphysical and the occult and the supernatural and got it all.
Yes. I mean, keep in mind that without the divination stuff, the Trump deck was reproducing a sort of medieval worldview in the sense that the cards had a hierarchy that doesn't make a lot of sense to us in the modern world, but would have been more culturally available to people, understanding how it goes from like the fool at the bottom to the world at the top, like that whole range of what's more important.
Absolutely, yeah. Talking about the feudal system and the social structure of the time, yeah, that's alien to us now.
Yes. You know, it might as well be just random pictures.
I mean, there are little bits and pieces that might resonate with us, but yeah, certainly from a different time. But I think that a lot of these terms and labels just have been co-opted by us today.
Absolutely.
In the way that tarot is used.
I know we did an episode where we talked about Western esotericism. Part of that talks about how in the late 1800s, just to narrow it down to, you know, a century, in the late decades of the 1800s, there was the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, a group of British aristocratic type people, upper class people, who were interested in the occult and got together and sort of systematized this thinking, both in like in ritual magic and ideas about, you know, how society should be put together. It was full of poets and artists, and they end up being incredibly influential in a lot of ways. And one of the ways they're influential is A.E. Waite, who was one of the members, gets really interested in the tarot and wants to make his own deck with his own symbolism. So he partners up with an artist named Pamela Coleman Smith, and she illustrates it. They produce the card deck through William Ryder and Sons, and this becomes known as the Ryder-Waite deck. I like to think of it as the Ryder-Waite-Smith deck or the Waite-Smith deck, because I know it's important that it had a publisher, but in the big picture, it's more about the symbolism and the art.
But we do seem to see that a lot, that even though these things are often today associated with women. Oh, it's women who see psychics. It's women who believe in all these kinds of things.
Yes.
You know, often men were really at the forefront of these kinds of things, particularly as inventions, and would often have women doing the design of the cards. We get the same thing with Aleister Crowley's cards as well, which we'll get into soon. But the women are often erased from history.
Yes, and which has another kind of irony in that it's a sort of a fake history. But I'm going to bring this all together here in just a second, or I'm going to try. So here's what happens: the Rider-Waite-Smith deck becomes very popular. But very popular in tarot at this time is not crazy. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like everybody has one until the 1960s. Yeah. So not you know, so about 60 years after the original deck is produced, I think it's the American Card Company. There's an American Card Game Company, American Game Company. I forget, so I didn't write that down. But
American Tarot Cards were produced by U.S. Games Systems Incorporated, which was founded in 1968 by Stuart R. Kaplan. And originally, it only produced the Rider-Waite-Smith Tarot Deck, but now produces over 400 proprietary items from over 20 categories, including tarot, playing card games, children's games, etc.
An American company decides to reproduce the deck in the heart of the sort of 1960s New Age explosion. And holy crap,
it goes
super viral. And so suddenly this deck has been, now it's been reproduced 100 million times. That's not an exaggeration. Like it's like for that's a card so deck, it's really popular.
Well, so interesting. I mean, it seems to be following a little bit of a trajectory like the Ouija board too.
Yep.
But it's interesting that what was a card game, a game, and then it becomes this tool for divination and fortune telling, and then a game again, and that's how it really goes viral.
Yeah.
But so, well, through a
Right, it's being published by Game Company, but they're doing it. Yeah, exactly. They're doing it as a divination tool, publishing this deck, but it's being published by a gaming company, and it like the same way that the Ouija board's being published by a game company. Exactly. It's a beautiful deck, and what happens is people start, it's lost its copyright at this point, and so people see the popularity and they're like, that's cool, but I'd rather see it done with X, or I'd rather see it done with Y. And a ton,
Ozzy Osbourne,
yes, exactly. A ton of people have redone the decks with their own art or changed the symbolism. And it's all people sort of riffing on this idea that, again, the idea emerges in the late 1700s, kind of really gets properly systematized in the 1800s, and then explodes in popular culture in the 1960s. So you now see all kinds of variants, some based on fictional things, some based on real things, all with their own allegories and symbolism. So
I think the internet age has also reinvigorated the interest in tarot. And I mean, certainly you can see them in bookstores, but just you find them everywhere online. And I think being skeptics, they're still beautiful from an artistic viewpoint.
Well,
and,
they are.
I mean, I've had tarot decks, and Matt, my husband, he's had tarot decks, and I think most people I know have had them, whether they believe in them or not.
Yes, well, there you go.
Tool of divination.
And even if you don't believe in them as being able to help you foresee the future, they certainly, without a doubt, have poetic and symbolic significance for people. Even people who don't literally believe they're going to tell the future, it can give them something to focus on. It can give them something, you know, people will find symbolism and parallels with their real life. I mean, and it's got that Barnum effect sort of built in, right?
Yes. And I do want to talk about that a little bit too, and just modern uses of tarot cards.
And that's the end of part one of our coverage of tarot. We'll be back next week with part two, where we'll continue to look at how tarot cards are used for divination and their cultural impact.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard part one of our two-part episode on tarot cards. There's a lot more to uncover in part two, so join us next week as we look into the way that mysticism and creativity have added exotic pseudo-antiquity and meaning to what was, for centuries, a mundane but popular card game. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as Big Picture Science, Good Job Brain, and My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Check out our Monster Talk merchandise at monstertalk.org/store, where you can find a variety of cool products to show that you're a next level monster enthusiast. Monster Talk is produced by Monster House, LLC, and our theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for making our show a part of your listening life.
In a Monster House presentation.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.